So this is the first lecture in the unit on digestion, and I'm going to give you sort of an overview of digestion and specifically talk about the digestion of proteins today. So there are two parts to the mammalian digestive system. We're going to specifically talk about humans, and you can see the illustration over there on the right. The first is the alimentary canal, and that basically is the, you know, the entire digestive tract. And we'll start at the beginning, which is the mouth, which is the opening, and then that enters what's called the oral cavity. The oral cavity includes the teeth and the tongue. We then enter what's known as the pharynx, and the pharynx is the area where the oral cavity meets the nasal cavity, sort of at the back of the throat. And then from there, can everyone say pharynx for me? And then we go through a tube called the esophagus. Everyone say the esophagus? And that enters the stomach, which is down here, kind of next to the liver, sort of partially maybe covered by the liver. And then after that, we enter, but the food enters the small intestine. The small intestine goes on for more than 20 feet, pretty long tube. And so the word small refers to the diameter. It does not refer to the length. And then we go into the large intestine, or the food goes into the large intestine, and the large intestine is shorter than the small intestine. And so what we mean by small and large is simply the diameter. So the small intestine is a small diameter, the large intestine has a large diameter, and the large intestine begins down here. It goes up, over, and then down. And then all the remaining, whatever's left over after digestion, is stored in the rectum, and then at the appropriate time, it leaves through the anus. And that's the entire canal there. The other important part of the digestive tract are called the accessory glands, and the first that we encounter in the oral cavity are the salivary glands, and we all have three of these, and they provide saliva. Saliva has several functions. The saliva provides, there are some enzymes. The most important enzyme is called salivary amylase, and amylase digests carbohydrates. We'll talk about that in a few days. And then, of course, it just provides the saliva, which allows the food to move through the upper part of the digestive tract. It, you know, sort of allows it to sort of slip through there. The pancreas is found down right below the stomach. It's actually the beginning of the small intestine, the first foot of it, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, sort of does a hairpin turn there, and the pancreas kind of sits in that hairpin turn. And then the liver is another important part of the digestive tract, and it's the largest organ in the body. And although some people call the skin an organ, but in terms of internally, the largest organ. And then the gallbladder sits sort of behind the liver, and it stores bile. We'll talk more about that in a later lecture. Okay, so let's now sort of take a trip through the digestive tract. And we'll do that using proteins. So first of all, let's do a review. What are proteins? Anybody want to volunteer a guess? What are proteins? Yeah. Very good. Chains, long chains of amino acids. How many different amino acids are there? Anyone want to take a guess? Yeah. 20. Very good. And then how many of these amino acids can we humans make from the raw ingredients of carbon, nitrogen, oxygen? Literally, we make these amino acids from scratch. How many of the 20 do we make from scratch? Does anyone know? Yeah. Very close, actually. Turns out that it's 12. So 12 we make from scratch. It's like if you make brownies from scratch. You don't go out and get a brownie mix that has everything already there. You just add water or something. You actually, you know, take flour and sugar and water and butter, you know, and all that stuff. Put it together. That's essentially what we do with eight of these. 12 of these. So 12 we make from scratch. 8 of them we don't make from scratch. We actually can't make them at all. So we have to get them from our diet. And because we must get them from our diet, we call them essential amino acids. Now, I want you to understand, all amino acids are essential. I mean, we need every one of them. The reason we call these essential is because we need to get them in our diet because we can't make them. We can't make them we just can't produce them. And so we can get them in any of these food items. We can get them in milk, all 8 of them, in eggs, and in meat. Those 3 food items will give us all 8 essential amino acids. So if you are eating those on a regular basis, then you're fine. Now, in the case that you're a vegetarian, you got to be a little more careful, because it turns out that there's only a couple of plants that actually contain all 8 of these essential amino acids. And as far as I've been able to do in terms of my research, and I may not be perfectly correct on this, but I believe oats and quinoa and soybeans all contain all 8 essential amino acids. So if you're a vegetarian and you're eating all those, then you're fine. Now, if you aren't eating those on a regular basis and you're a vegetarian, then you got to be very careful, because some vegetables contain some of the essential amino acids, but not the others. And if you're missing even one essential amino acid in your diet, then you can't make proteins that have that amino acid, right? And that can really mess you up. So you really want to make sure you get all, that you have all 20 amino acids, which means the 8 that are essential, you make sure you get those in your diet. So my little picture over here shows grains and beans. And grains provide us with 6 of the essential amino acids. Beans provide us with 6 amino acids, but they're not the exact same. Turns out that grains and beans both provide us with the same 4 amino acids, but grains have 2 amino acids that beans don't have, and beans have 2 essential amino acids that grains don't have. So if you're going to get the right diet and you're a vegetarian, you're going to eat grains and beans. So you'll have tortilla chips with a bean dip, let's say. Then you're covered. So we call these complementary proteins because they complement one another. If you eat them both, then you're good. Okay? Now, here's an interesting thing. Digestion begins in the oral cavity. And the interesting thing about the oral cavity is it contains teeth. And teeth aid in the mechanical breakdown of food. Very important for all animals. Turns out that the kind of dentition that a mammal has actually indicates what it eats. So you can actually look at the organism and you can know, oh, it must eat this kind of food. So, for example, carnivores, if you look at carnivores, they have very large canines, very sharp premolars and molars. And this dentition is for ripping flesh, for eating meat, right? And it makes total sense that a carnivore would have this. An herbivore has no canines, and you can see here, no canines. But they do have very sharp scissor-like incisors, and they use this to cut the vegetation that they eat. And then they have, their molars are very flat, and they're good for grinding. So they clip the vegetation, then they grind it, and there they go. Omnivores have a dentition that's somewhere between the two, and you can see here, we are an example of an omnivore, so we don't have the really long, sharp canines or molars that the carnivores have, but we do have canines, and we do have molars that are sort of sharp, and premolars as well, but we're clearly not like herbivores. So we're somewhere in between. So we are omnivores. That means we eat both meat and herb and plants. And if you're vegetarian, you can tell your vegetarian friends that if humans were meant to be vegetarians, they would have a dentition that looks like this, where we would have no canines. But we do have canines. So we've evolved in an environment where we eat both meat and plants, and our dentition gives that away. So that tells, that should tell you what you're supposed to eat. So you don't have to feel bad if you, you know, if you're not a vegetarian. You can be, it's okay to eat meat. We evolved that way. Okay, pharynx to the esophagus. It turns out that we have two tubes that descend from the pharynx. Now remember, the pharynx is at the back of the throat. It's where the nasal cavity and the oral cavity meet. And the first tube is called the trachea. It's in front. It's in the front, you know, of your neck. And you can actually feel it in your neck. And, you know, take your fingers right now and run your fingers down your neck, and you'll feel that you can actually feel these rings of cartilage that are in your trachea. And, you know, maybe it's kind of creepy to feel that, but it's there. And the cartilage is there to prevent your trachea from collapsing when you take a breath of air, because when you take a breath of air, the air goes through your trachea down into your lungs. The trachea is the passageway to your lungs, and you don't want that tube collapsing if you take a breath. So the cartilage maintains it to be, you know, in an open state. Now, behind your trachea, you can't feel it, is your esophagus. And it's actually a passageway to your stomach, not to your lungs, and it's collapsible. Now, there's another interesting tissue. It's called the epiglottis, and it prevents food from going down the trachea. And what it will do is when you swallow, either, you know, to drink water, you know, some kind of fluid, or you're eating, the epiglottis will cover the opening to the trachea and prevent any kind of fluid or food going down the trachea, because you don't want it going down that tube, because that's going to your lungs. And the word derivation, the opening to the trachea is called the glottis, and the prefix epi means up on, and so the word epiglottis means up on the glottis. Can you all say that for me? Epiglottis. Very good. Now, swallowing is a reflex. When you're not swallowing, if you look at my picture here, here's the trachea in front of the neck. Here's the esophagus behind. And you'll see that there's a muscle up at the top of your esophagus. It's actually a circular muscle, and it's contracted. So the esophageal sphincter is contracted, and notice that the epiglottis is up. So most of the time, you're breathing. So your epiglottis is, your epiglottis is up, your esophageal sphincter is contracted, and your trachea is therefore open. Air can flow down to your lungs. Now, when you swallow, swallowing is a reflex. So when you get a bolus of food in the back of your oral cavity, it reaches your pharynx, you start a reflex response. And what happens is the esophageal sphincter will relax so that bolus of food can now enter the esophagus. Also, the larynx, which is the top part of the trachea, will move up. And when it moves up, the epiglottis moves down, and you cover the opening to the trachea, and that prevents the food or liquid going down into the trachea. And then the bolus of food will go where it needs to go, because the esophageal sphincter is opened up. And this is a reflex. So once it starts, it continues. It doesn't stop. And you can see why, because you don't want a bolus of food just stopping halfway down here, because then you would block the opening to the trachea. And you can't do that, because you need to be getting oxygen to your lungs, which then gets oxygen to your tissues. That needs to be happening constantly. So if this process has to sort of continue until the bolus of food gets out of this area and it gets down into your esophagus. Now, if someone is choking, then what's happened is this area is blocked up here. The pharynx is blocked with a bolus of food. And so if someone is choking, they cannot tell you they're choking. They don't look at you and say, hey, I'm choking. Could you help me out here? Because their airway is literally blocked. So what they will look like is they will look very distressed. They won't be able to say anything. And they'll probably be pointing at their throat or their mouth, and they'll start turning blue. And when that happens, you need to act quickly, go over and do the Heimlich maneuver or hit them on the back or whatever it takes to get that bolus of food out of their mouth, out of their being stuck back at the back of their throat. What's that? Have you? What did you say? What's that? Yeah, I guess babies you can hit on the back, but the Heimlich, you guys know how to do the Heimlich, so do the Heimlich on them. Okay, peristalsis. Peristalsis is what moves the food along through the digestive tract. It turns out that the entire lining of your digestive tract, starting at your esophagus all the way through the very end, you've got two sets of muscles. You have circular muscles that ring the digestive tract, and you've got longitudinal muscles that go along the digestive tract. And there's an alternating contracting and relaxing of these muscles that causes waves of these waves to go through your digestive tract. And that movement, that wave-like movement, is called peristalsis. Can you all say that for me? Peristalsis. Now, you have no conscious control over this. So you can't kind of sit here and go, food is in my stomach. I want to move it into my small intestine. You know, and then all of a sudden, peristalsis starts happening and you've emptied your stomach. It doesn't work that way. Your body automatically controls this process. Yeah. That goes pretty quickly because it goes pretty much straight down through your esophagus. It goes right down. But once it gets down into your stomach, then it stays a while. And it depends on what kind of food is there, how long it stays. Yeah. Yeah, that's how the food moves. It's not really gravity that's moving the food. It's peristalsis. So you could actually be upside down, and peristalsis will still move the food into your stomach. Yeah, and still move it through your digestive tract. Yeah. It depends on, it fills up, and then it detects, it's very complicated, actually. There's this whole hormonal feedback loop that tells the stomach, okay, you've digested enough, now it's time to move the food on into the small intestine. And it can be different lengths of time depending on what food, how well digested it is, and so forth. So it depends. So anyhow, it just varies. So proteins actually really begin digesting in the stomach. I mean, technically they begin in the mouth when you mechanically break down, like if you start eating meat, right? You start chewing it. So I guess technically protein digestion begins in the oral cavity, but the chemical digestion of proteins doesn't begin until you get to the stomach. Now, I want to remind you, your salivary glands do give off an enzyme. That enzyme is called salivary amylase. But amylase doesn't digest proteins, it digests carbohydrates. So carbohydrate digestion begins in the mouth. Protein digestion, really chemically, digestion begins in the stomach. And the stomach contains what we call gastric juice. And gastric juice includes water, hydrochloric acid, and an enzyme called pepsin. And the hydrochloric acid gives the stomach a very low pH, pH of 1 or 2. And that causes proteins to be denatured. Remember we talked about how proteins have a tertiary structure? Well, you put them in an acidic environment and they start unraveling. That's called denaturing. And that allows then pepsin to start attacking the protein and chopping it into smaller pieces. Now, pepsin really begins its life as an inactive enzyme called pepsinogen. And if you actually look at my picture, I have it listed there. Can everyone say pepsinogen? So the cells that line the stomach actually create this enzyme called pepsinogen. But you don't want it to be in its active form. Otherwise, it would start digesting the cells itself, right? There's lots of proteins inside the cell, and you don't want that to happen. So your cells actually manufacture an inactive form of the enzyme. That inactive form, pepsinogen, is secreted into the stomach. In the presence of an acidic environment, it then gets transformed into pepsin, which is now the active form of the enzyme, and now it can start digesting the protein. And actually, there's a nice illustration up here on my slide where you see pepsinogen, you know, that's the way it's first created. When it leaves the lining of the stomach and goes into the stomach itself, it experiences the low pH. That causes part of the protein to be chopped off. And now the active site is fully functional, and now it can start working as an active enzyme, which we call pepsin. The digested material, when it's finally broken down, is called chyme. Can everyone say that? And so chyme is then squirted from the stomach into the small intestine. Now, before it goes into the small intestine, what's a problem with this? The chyme is being squirted into the small intestine. Do you see any problem? Yeah. It's very, very acidic. So you've got to neutralize that. So one of the very first things that has to happen is you have to add some base to neutralize the acid so you have more of a neutral pH. And we'll see what happens there. Now, the very first foot of the small intestine has a special name. It's called the duodenum. Can you say that? Duodenum. Or you can pronounce it duodenum. Yeah. So you'll hear it pronounced both ways, duodenum or duodenum. And it's the most important part, I think, of the entire digestive tract, that first foot. And if you look at my illustration, you'll see there's the beginning of the small intestine. It does a hairpin turn, and you'll notice that there's this accessory organ sitting right in that hairpin turn, and it's called the pancreas. Now, if you look at the small intestine, the first foot is called the duodenum, and the rest of the small intestine is where most of the duodenum and the rest of the small intestine is where most of the digestion occurs, and then absorption of the digested materials occurs. And the small intestine it goes through these amazing foldings. If you look at the cross section here, first of all, the small intestine folds upon itself, as you can see. And if you actually look on the surface of these folds, you'll see finger-like projections, and they're called villi, and I have a villi illustrated here. And then if you actually look at the individual cells on the villi, they actually have little fingers themselves called microvilli. So you have this multiple folding from the folds in the small intestine to the actual villi to the actual microvilli. And if you look, if you add up the entire surface area of the entire small intestine, it's about the surface area of a tennis court. And that's because the main purpose of the small intestine is to absorb all these materials. And it has a very long length. It's about 6 meters, which is around 20 feet roughly, maybe a little bit more, 20 feet in length. And, that's for, of course, the absorption. If we take a closer look at the pancreas, the first thing that we note is the pancreas gives off bicarbonate, and that's to neutralize the acidic chyme, because you want it to be fairly neutral when it goes through the small intestine. And also the pancreas dumps a number of different digestive enzymes into the duodenum. Once again, they are inactive, and then they become active once they get into the small intestine. And the important enzymes for the breakdown of proteins are trypsin and chymotrypsin. Can you say that? Trypsin? Chymotrypsin. Now, they are, once again, originally, they are in their inactive form, and I have them up here. You can see them on, it's hard to see maybe on my illustration, but if you actually look, you'll see that they are inactive at first, and they're called trypsinogen. Can you say that for me? And it will become trypsin. And then you have chymotrypsinogen. Can you say that? And it will become chymotrypsin. And obviously it's not acid that causes the conversion. It's something else. But they become converted into their active forms. And then you have carboxy pep. And by the way, these will break peptide bonds at specific amino acids, and so it'll chop them into smaller pieces. And then carboxypeptidase, can you say that for me? Once again, carboxypeptidase and aminopeptidase. They will break peptide bonds coming from either end, one by one, depending on the, you're coming from the amino end or the carboxyl end, and they'll just chop them off one at a time. Whereas the trypsin and chymotrypsin will cut somewhere in the middle at specific amino acids. Now, in this last slide, you get a great overview of digestion, and you start with the tertiary protein. You see what happens in the stomach with pepsin, chopping it into smaller pieces. Then you get into the small intestine and the enzymes coming from the pancreas, like, you know, trypsin, chymotrypsin, carboxypeptidase, aminopeptidase, will chop it. And eventually, you end up with just amino acids, and these amino acids are absorbed through the small intestine. Now, the important thing to realize is that all the foods and nutrients are absorbed in the small intestine. When you get to the large intestine is not, its function is not to absorb any nutrients. That's already happened. So you ask yourself, well, what's the large, you know, why do we have a large intestine? The main function of the large intestine is to reabsorb water, because you have a lot of water in your small intestine, you know, to keep things moving through. And so you want to recover that water. So that's the function of the large intestine. And then another function is it has a nice, healthy population of E. coli. And that E. coli has a symbiotic relationship with us. E. coli makes vitamin K. All right. Good, you know, good going, E. coli. So we want those E. coli to stay in our large intestine and just crank out a lot of vitamin K that we then absorb. So we provide some nutrients to the E. coli. They provide a vitamin for us. Yeah. It's different species. So E. coli will come in a whole bunch of different subspecies, and some are bad for us and some are good for us. And we live with, there's a whole number of different species or subspecies of E. coli that live in our gut our entire lives, and they're very helpful to us. Occasionally you get some nasty species by eating, subspecies by eating food, and then they can hurt you, okay? Yeah. Vitamin K is used in blood clotting. It's very important in blood clotting, as you'll see when we get to the circulatory system. And when at the very end of the digestive tract, the rectum is where you just hold all the waste material until you're ready to get rid of it. And you just store it there until, you know, you're ready to eliminate it in, through the anus, okay? But that's the whole trip through your digestive tract.